Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. You'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalog of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. But we will get started on today's episode where we'll be talking to one Ellie Bender. Ellie Bender, CDBC, CPDTKASBA, is the founder and co-owner of Pet Harmony Animal Behavior and Training and co-author of Canine Enrichment for the Real World. Through Pet Harmony, Ellie helps pets all over the world and their people have a more harmonious household. And she and her business partner, Emily Strong, run a mentorship program for budding behavioral professionals. Pet Harmony Program Campus to help establish behavior professionals achieve their wildest behavior consulting dreams and the first train home program for shelters. Ellie is a national speaker, published author, an animal welfare advocate, and has made radio, podcast, commercial, and TV appearances. She has been working with rescue groups and shelters since 2006 in various capacities, including founding a student-run animal welfare organization. Ellie started dog training professionally in 2012, and by 2015 became the lead dog behavior consultant for a large multi-species animal sanctuary. Ellie has a bachelor's in animal science from Iowa State University and is certified through the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants and Council for Certification of Professional Dog Trainers. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome Ellie to the show today, who is patiently waiting by. Ellie, gratitude to you. Thank you so much for taking the time to come and hang out with us at Animal Training Academy.
Thanks, Ryan, so much. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Me too, and I love your bright green background. And
thank you.
It's awesome. I've always felt so bland. Did you choose that color yourself?
I did, yeah. And everybody said I was crazy when I was like, I want a lime green office. And I was like, it's my office. It can be any color I want. And now people are catching on that lime green is a good office color.
I can see your plant blending in the background. Do you feel that, you know, antecedents are so important? Do you feel that antecedent has changed how you operate?
Oh, absolutely. Like I come into my office and it's just like, oh, this is so nice to be in here. And I did a lot of things to make it more homey. And like, you can't see this, Ryan, but like the wall next to me is just like whiteboards and calendars and like my little type A brain just like on a wall. And yeah, it just makes me happy to be in here. It's a good antecedent arrangement.
I always love people's artwork in the background. So explain to people what I'm looking at. Is it a polar bear?
It is. So the artist, Laura Zombie, I think is her name. It was a well-done Facebook ad where I was like, that's an amazing piece of artwork. I need that. And so it's this little girl wearing a bear onesie and she's like roaring, yelling, and a polar bear behind her. And I was like, I want to be this badass little girl.
That's cool. What was the ad for?
It was like for her just like art shop. It was a picture of this print that I have. And I was like, that was effective. I'm going to buy this.
Shout out to that artist. That's cool. Yeah. And you're not alone in there. Who's sharing that space with you today?
Yes, I have my turtle. He's a red-eared slider named Zorro, and some feeder fish that he has not yet eaten yet. He has five feeder fish. So he is, I think, just hanging out in his tank. I don't see him up basking today. But if you hear him splashing around, that's what's happening.
He's got a pretty mean habitat. Is that Ali Bender designed?
It's really my dad designed, but I mostly executed. Yeah, he has a giant stock tank, and then we built this cool enclosure around it. And my next task is doing like an aquatic plant nursery above with like a like water pumping through to also filter and have like a little waterfall and all that. So that's my next task. And I have just a pump sitting on the ground next to me waiting to figure out that whole thing.
I understand. I have a doorstop sitting on the ground next to me that's been there for a couple of years. Yeah.
This you will be installed one day, I promise.
Hey, let's dive straight into the first question today, Ali. We're curious to hear how you got started. Can you take us back to where your Behaviour Nerd Odyssey started and share some stories with us from your journey so far?
Absolutely. So I started in shelters and rescues before I got into behavior. And my whole world was shelters. You know, at 13, I decided I'm going to open a shelter and single-handedly solve animal homelessness, you know, with the zeal that only a teenager has. So that was my entire life. You know, that's what I went to school for, all my internships, my jobs, everything was for that in mind. And, you know, I had experiences that now looking back on it, I was like, that's what prepared me for this. You know, I took a lot of enrichment courses in college, and it was something I was really interested in, but it was all like, how do I apply this to a shelter world? And after college, I was working part-time. I had four part-time jobs because animal science does not pay the big bucks after graduation. And I was working in one of my local shelters, and I had a couple of back-to-back experiences with dogs who, I mean, to put it bluntly, we just couldn't help. We didn't know enough to be able to help them. They had behavior issues that they were euthanized for. And looking back on it, it was like, you know what? I could have helped that animal now. But at the time, I just didn't have the knowledge or skills. And in retrospect, those situations are what got me on the behavior path, where I started realizing, you know, what my area needs is not another shelter or another rescue. We have so many amazing organizations in my area. That's not what was needed. What was needed was people who knew how to help those animals who were falling through the cracks and deteriorating in a typical shelter setup. And so I started working full-time for one of the organizations that I had a part-time job with, and I was doing everything, because at that point, I still thought I wanted to open my shelter. This is, you know, a decade later, still with the same goal, same dream of opening a shelter. And my job was I was a program manager for a local animal welfare organization, and I was doing everything that I would have to do if I had a shelter. You know, I was doing donations and program development and marketing and fundraising and like all of that sort of stuff. And I hated it so much. I just hated it. And I was still dog training on the side. That was the only part-time job I kept was dog training on the side. And I just kind of woke up one day and I was like, I don't want to do this. I just want to train dogs. I really enjoy that. And so was lost for a while because I just gave up the dream that I had for, you know, almost half my life, and found a full-time animal consulting job, and that has led me to here, Pet Harmony, and talking to you guys.
Awesome. And I've definitely been there where I feel like I've had a dream and then something happened and I'm like, I don't want to do that anymore. And you're like, well, yeah. What does that mean? and using that word dream, you said you had the same goal and dream as you got older. For a 13-year-old to want to save the world, would you... And I ask this just because of recent musings about dreamers, and specifically Steve Martin talks about being a dreamer. Steve Martin from Natural Encounters Incorporated in Florida. He talks about the importance of being a dreamer.
Yeah.
Do you identify with that?
You know, I would say, like, it makes me uncomfortable to say that I identify as that, right? But looking at how other people interact with the world, I would be remiss to say I'm not. You know, I was really, really fortunate that my parents cultivated that in me. And, you know, they were still realistic, right? You know, at 13, I was like, I want to open an animal shelter. And they're like, well, you're not going to like make money doing that. And I was like, I don't care about money because, you know, 13. And so I was really, really fortunate that I had parents who cultivated that. And both of my parents are entrepreneurs as well. And so I grew up in that mindset of like, you just start things and you do things.
I definitely understand that as well. You're not going to make money doing that, Ryan. But also the support. I say that as a joke. I also resonate with the support. Hey, you mentioned those back-to-back experiences that you had at the shelter and how those kind of were a bit of a, what's it called, leapboard for you to kind of springboard?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, springboard.
leapboard.
It works.
My brain, sometimes you don't serve me well. Springboard to serve you, to spring you into the behavior consulting side of things. Yeah. And I always, you know, I can think back on my early times engaging with non-human learners and feel a little bit of a, personally, I'm not speaking about you, I'm just speaking about myself, personally feeling a little bit of regret and a little bit of guilt. But also like just overwhelmed with gratitude for the lessons that I can now draw from those experiences. Can you share any more about those early experiences you had and in hindsight, kind of what you took away from them that still guide you today?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of these stories I tell pretty frequently, or told pretty frequently, like back when we could do in-person conferences. And so one of them, his name was Sarge, and he was this cute kind of like bully cattle dog type mix. He had the like chunky bully body and the little shorter snout, but these giant radar cattle dog ears, and he was white with these caramel colored spots. And he came into the shelter. He was a transfer from another shelter, and I was there when he showed up, and he was just the coolest dog. You know, he was one of those dogs who was up for anything. You know, he was like training, yes, walking, yes, just like raring to go with everything. But at the end of the day, like if you just spent time in his kennel with him, he would snuggle up next to you. And he was just a really, really cool dog. But he was a young adolescent, as far as we know, a high energy dog in a traditional shelter setup. And those dogs typically don't do well in those environments. And so I watched him deteriorate for 3 months, and I tried everything that I knew how to do at the time. You know, I was a part-time trainer, but I was a trainer. I wasn't a behavior consultant by any means at that point in time. And so, you know, I would try training things with him. I developed an environmental enrichment program for him. Everybody got to benefit, but it was for him that I created it. And I just continued to watch him deteriorate. So he developed barrier reactivity. He developed leash reactivity, especially to children, and some stereotypic behaviors as well. And I came into the shelter one day, and they had an outdoor run, and he was in the outdoor run. And I thought to myself, you know, that's weird that he's in the outdoor run. It's, you know, adoption hours are starting in a few minutes, and everybody should be back in their kennels. And so I found my manager and asked her, you know, should I put him back? Why is he out there? And she told me that he had an incident the night before and was going to be euthanized in the next few minutes. And that, like, even now, I mean, it's 9 years later at this point, and I still tear up thinking about him, you know, because I didn't know enough to be able to help him. And he was just such a cool dog, and I really wish that I could have helped him. And you know, the nice thing now is he's helped me help so many more dogs just like him. But you know, it's hard to talk about him. The other one, and I don't remember if she was before or after Sarge. Her name was Tia. And she was like an 8-month-old little minpin. she was so cute. And I don't remember if she was before or after, but it was around the same time. And she came in. She was an owner surrender from the sweetest couple. And I did the surrender. You know, I was at a shelter that the animal care staff did everything. And so I did their surrender, and it was the sweetest couple. It was their first dog, and they didn't know that they had allergies, and they tried everything. Like, they tried the HEPA filters, and they tried, you know, the medications, and, you know, like, all of this. They really did try a lot to be able to keep her, and it just wasn't tenable. And so, you know, that was like an added layer to it of I met these people. And so she came in, and I was at a shelter that did assessments, and at the time would euthanize for certain behaviors for assessments. They no longer are as black and white as they were with that. And she had some really intense food guarding, like really intense food guarding, especially for a little 8-month-old kiddo. And she was euthanized for that behavior. And I spoke with the family afterwards. They called to ask how she was. And I, you know, serendipitously in a bad way was the one who answered the phone, and they asked how she was doing. And I mean, I was young. I was in my early 20s. Like, I lied through my teeth. I could not tell this couple that their dog had been euthanized, and whether that was right or wrong, that's what happened. And, you know, so those two are really the ones that I think about when I think about, like, the catalyst, the springboard for getting me into behavior of, like, oh man, it didn't have to happen that way for either of them. And now we know better, and now we have more tools.
Well, thank you for your vulnerability and sharing on those stories. People can never obviously see, I guess, but I can share with you the emotion that you expressed across the Zoom lens today. So appreciate your bravery,
of course,
in jumping on here with us and talking about that. And you say, though, that now those lessons help your current clients and the learners you engage with. It sounds kind of, I get the sense that it lit a fire under you.
It did. Yeah, it was. I had always been interested in behavior, but it wasn't until I was like, this is how I can do better for them, you know? So it did light a fire, especially those two.
I mean, bring us up to writing Canine Enrichment for the Real World as a dreamer.
Yeah.
What was your dream?
Did Emily tell this story already when she talked to you of how she roped me into this?
I don't believe she did.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So Emily tells it better. But this was not a dream that I thought I would realize. So interestingly enough, when I was a kid, like younger, you know, when I was maybe in elementary school, I did want to be an author at one point in time in my life. Like I would write stories. I loved it. I was on that path, but for fiction. And so Emily and I, this was when we were working for the same organization, and a colleague that we have through that organization had been approached by Dogwise several times and she to write a book, and she couldn't because of her non-compete clause. And she said, but you know what? Like I know someone who would be really good at this. And so she gave them Emily's name, and Emily connected with Dogwise and had a meeting with them and all that. And they wanted a book on enrichment. They had several proposals written to them, sent to them in the past, but it was never like exactly what they were looking for. And so they sat on the idea for years. I don't remember how long, but for quite a while. And so they talked to Emily. Emily told them her idea for the book, and they were like, yes, this is exactly what we're looking for. It sounds like you're the right person to write this. And she said, oh, by the way, my professional wife, Allie, and I, you know, we do everything together. We do all of our projects together. So I really want Allie to write this with me. And they said, sure, yeah, that sounds good. Like, we don't normally have co-authors, but we don't see why we can't. We can do that. You know, you and Allie can write the book. And Emily finished the meeting and then said, oh, I should tell Allie that she's going to write a book with me. So she comes back we shared an office at that point. She comes back to the office. I knew that she had the meeting with them, and I was asking her about the meeting. And so she's telling me, and she's like, oh, by the way, you're writing this with me. And not even a week before, when she had told me about her meeting, I was like, oh, I would love to write a book. But you know what? I don't think I'm ready for that. I don't think I'm at that point in my life or my career that I can do that. And she said no to that. And we wrote a book together. So it was a dream thrust upon me at that point.
Just before we push record today, we've been reading your book, Canine Enrichment for the Real World, in the ATA Book Club. And I said, hey, Ellie, can we just confirm the date for your live Q&A you're going to do for our members? And you're like, yeah, let me look at my calendar. Oh, I can see Emily's already put it in there. And I'm confirmed. And did you just refer to Emily as your professional wife?
Yes. Yeah. It's, you know, when you have somebody in your life and you're like, you're more than just like a friend or a business partner. Like she's essentially a spouse level, but on the professional side, as opposed to like the personal side.
It reminds me of Emily Johnson Vey and Ava Bertelsen. They say they have a shared brain.
Yes.
I think Ava went. Oh no, Ava went on. I don't know if I can say that. I won't say that. So, how did you and Emily meet? Share that story with us.
You know, it's funny you ask, because a few weeks ago, I texted Emily and I was like, you know what? I want to be one of those people where we give a different story every time we tell people how we met, and we are going to come up with stories together, and we haven't. And so I'll tell you, I guess, the real story, but I shouldn't tell you it's the real story. I should tell you this is one of the made up stories. Anywho.
Yeah. Is that what you say every time you share a made up story?
Oh, that's what, yeah, I should just like tell that disclaimer and be like, this is the real one. Okay, thank you, Ryan. Thank you for helping me on this endeavor.
Fake news versus real news, people. Nowadays, right? You don't know what
you
to
decide.
Believe.
So we, as I mentioned, we worked at the same organization, and she was already there at that organization, just in a different role. In like a different department. She was working with birds, and I was hired on for dogs. And she had a foster kiddo that she wanted to like bounce ideas off of with my manager. And the relevant part, backstory to know is that I have a terrible startle response. It is really an unfortunate startle response. It sounds a little bit like, a little bit like a fire alarm that you hear in like a big building. Like my college dorm had this fire alarm that was like, bang, bang, bang. And it sounds a little bit like that, but with like human noises. So she was just sitting in the lobby to the building that housed my office, which was with the puppies. Because, you know, that's what what dog people do is like, you're just going to be with them. So she was sitting innocently in the lobby. I walk in to the building, see a person sitting there who I wasn't expecting to be sitting there, and proceed to have my startle response, which is like a like just screaming intermittently and while staring at her. And it goes on for way longer than necessary. And she just looked at me, and finally I stopped screaming, and she said, sorry. And I said, sorry, I didn't know anybody was going to be sitting there. And she was like, yeah, clearly. And I continued on to my office. And then a few minutes later, she comes in to talk to my manager. And that is how Emily and I met.
Let's write a book. Right?
And she was like, I like this person enough to tie myself to her for the rest of my life.
Oh, that is hilarious. Can you now proceed to demonstrate your startle response for all of us listening? No, I'm just joking. Hey,
I was going to say, it's a little loud.
Turn your volume down, everyone. Hey, tell us about what occupies your time now, about Pet Harmony, animal behavior and training. I know there's more than just you and Emily in there. And share with us a little bit about your mentorship program and where people can go to online to find out more.
Absolutely. It has grown beyond me and Emily, which is really exciting. We currently have Ellen Yoakum, who is amazing and just like everything that she does in life. And then Mary Kay Kendrick, Corinne Collier, and Amy Sly are on our staff as well. And so Pet Harmony still takes up the majority of my life. You know, it's one of those where I just have different tasks to do than I did 5 years ago when it started. So still takes up the majority of my time. We have a lot of projects going on and all that. Otherwise, I volunteer for a local sustainability nonprofit because can't not volunteer. And it, also at our local animal services as well. So there's some volunteer work in there too. And then just like a lot of gardening and hanging out with my dog and personal spouse as opposed to professional spouse. but our mentorship program is, it's really cool, if I can say so myself, and I can because it's Emily's program, so I'm not just like self-promoting now. Emily's been working on this for years, and it's, you know, she and I both recognize, but this is really her calling to teach people how to become behavior consultants, because there isn't really a straight path to how to do that. You know, it's like, if you want to be a behaviorist, here you go. If you want to be a veterinary behaviorist, here you go. And even now, if you want to be a dog trainer, like there are dog training programs, but behavior consultants are just kind of free-floating and having to figure it out and piecemeal an education together. And that's what Emily and I both had to do. And I'm sure a lot of the people listening as well who are in that behavior consultant space. And so what we wanted to do was give people a path of, here's what you need to know in order to be a competent consultant based off of IWBC's core competencies. And also the human side of consulting, which is not talked about a lot in just like in our profession, and is like an entire half of what we do is how do we be empathetic consultants to our clients, even if they are doing everything wrong, but still treating them, you know, with the respect and empathy that they deserve, because at the end of the day, they're just trying to do the best that they can with the knowledge and skill set that they have. And they've hired us to help grow that skill set. I mean, sometimes they hire us for other reasons that are beyond that. But, you know, for the most part, we hope they're hiring us to help them. So how do we do that? So the mentorship program is a way for people to have a clear path forward on how to become a competent behavior consultant. And to learn more information, on our website, we have all of that jazz. I want to say it's petharmonytraining.com/PHMP for Pet Harmony Mentorship Program. And I can double check that that's correct right now. I also do all of our website stuff, so that it takes up a lot of my time. It is /PHMP.
Awesome. And we will link to that in the show notes as well for you listening if you want to navigate to it from there. Hey, thanks so much for sharing everything so far, Ellie. We love hearing about people's behavioral odysseys, so we appreciate you getting vulnerable in that space as well and sharing everything with us. Moving forward, I'd really like to build on the awesomeness of everything so far and also of our last episode with your wife and business partner, Emily Strong, where she offered her five biggest things she felt professionals should know about enrichment. And I love that we're going to build on this so beautifully. And now with your contribution, you've kindly put together a list for us as well, and that is five things you feel as professionals we can discuss with our clients to help them implement enrichment with their non-human learners. I can't wait to hear what these are. What's number one?
Number one is identifying our clients' pain points, all of their pain points, so that we can help them right now. I think one of the things that's really challenging for consultants who work primarily with maladaptive behaviors like Emily and I do is that we're like, well, in 3 months, I can get you relief. And that's A, not what people want to hear, but B, also like, not something that's going to make them continue going on the behavior modification journey with us. You know, those learners also need a reinforcement history in order to continue learning with us, you know, just like our pets or other animals do. So the first one is identifying their pain points so we can help them right now. And for me, a lot of times what that looks like is addressing kind of like the low-hanging fruit, like some of the nuisance behaviors first, where you say, okay, I recognize that your dog is eating everyone and has a lot of anxiety-related behaviors, and you're working with a VB for medication and all of that. But that whole jumping thing when you come home, like, let's work on that. That sounds like a good place to start. Let's figure out how some physical and mental exercise can help with the jumping at home. And a lot of times what I see with clients is, and you have to phrase it in a way that they're like, okay, I recognize that this is to help me in my day-to-day life with my animal, and you're not just like side skirting the problem. Like, we're still addressing the more serious maladaptive behaviors. But a lot of times, you know, they come back for their next session and they're like, oh man, day-to-day life is easier with my pet because of that. And you have that win for them. And so it's a lot easier to then say, okay, Now we're getting into the stuff that's a little bit more complicated to implement, that is going to take more time, that we're not going to have those easy wins with, but at least we've addressed some of the day-to-day pain that they're feeling. And so the first one is not being afraid to address the lower hanging fruit, get an easy win with your clients, and address their very real needs and concerns that they have right off the bat.
Any other input on how, as a consultant, we can go in and what kind of questions should we ask? How can we identify easy wins and create the motivation in our clients to maybe switch focus onto these different areas than what they called you for?
That's a really good question. And I would say a lot of those, that determination can come out of just the regular questions you would ask about the maladaptive behaviors, where you're like, okay, they have, let's say like separation anxiety, like there has been research saying like physical exercise can, to a point, help with some of the SA stuff. And I think I had enough disclaimers in there to make that an accurate statement. So you can say like, all right, I'm already thinking about physical exercise from that point of view of helping with the SA. Now let's see, you know, they're mentioning something, you know, and I ask my clients, is there anything else you want to tell me? Anything that bothers you about what your dog does? Just kind of give them a free form question like that. And they're like, you know what? This barking that happens at night is really annoying. And I'm like, okay, barking at night, usually like that's an indicator that that their enrichment plan needs a little bit of work. And so then it's like, all right, well, tell me what happens with the barking and when does it start and what's happening and who is it at, if it's at anybody. And then we can say like, okay, understand the barking. And so then you can say like, okay, how about we explore some physical exercise to help with this? Also, it can help with the SA later on. So a lot of times I'll find something that hits both of those, like the more serious maladaptive behaviors and, you know, some of those nuisance behaviors. Since physical exercise and like scent work can hit both of those things so well. So like almost everybody who sees me for an initial consultation walks away with Find It or scatter feeding or scent work or like some variation of all of that. And I explain to them, it's going to help with these nuisance behaviors. And we are going to incorporate essentially this with a few modifications for, you know, sound sensitivity or for the stranger danger that they're having or anything like that. So I try to pull something that will address both, and they feel better working on it in the nuisance category when they're like, all right, this will also help with the main reason that I contacted you.
So I get the feeling that it's a way of framing, and tell me if I'm wrong here or interpreting it differently than and how you intended it to be interpreted. It's a way of framing, treat your clients as learners and find a reinforceable behavior and go from there.
I think that's a good way of summing that up, yeah.
I'll take that. Number two.
Number two is have your client experiment with the details. So an example of what that can look like is when I've identified like, okay, we have some serious maladaptive behaviors. We also have some nuisance behaviors. Let's go after those first while they're still learning body language and all the things that they need to be safe while they work on the maladaptive behaviors. So I'll tell them, you know, the whole spiel of, you know, why we're doing this and all of that. And I'll tell them, okay, so I want you to work on physical, mental, and sometimes calming if we need help in that category. Often we do need help in that category. And I tell them, I don't just want you to experiment with mental versus physical exercise. I want you to experiment with the type of exercise. So for physical, you know, fetch, flirt, pull, tug, walks, if we've deemed that that's actually physical exercise, which is a teaser for the next point. and or running or swimming or whatever it is, mental find it, trick training, food puzzles, if that's stimulating for them, et cetera. I want you to experiment with the type of activity. I also want you to experiment with the duration of the activity and the time of day of the activity. And I give them the example of my dog, Oso, who I talk a lot about in the book because he's the four-legged love of my life. And sorry, Zorro, he can't hear me. He's in the water. But I tell them about Oso, who when his needs aren't being met, it's usually physical exercise. And we had to figure that out. You know, I tried real hard to just do like find it or something, some sort of mental exercise. And he was like, cool, thanks for the game. I'm still annoying. And so it has to be physical exercise for him. For him, tug works best. He likes it. I'm not strong enough, honestly, to play tug with Oso, so my husband plays with him. So it works for them. It works in our space too. Like, we have a small house, we have a big dog, and Chicago winters are like not a time that we want to have to do something outside with him. So tug works really well in our space. He enjoys it. We enjoy it. Life is good. It has to be though, at least 5 minutes of tug. If it's less than that, he will still be annoying after we play. If it's more than 5 minutes, then we're good to go. He'll just go and snooze afterwards. And for him, it has to be after 4:30 in the afternoon. We've tried to play tug in the morning. And for context, his witching hour, for lack of a better word, is in the evening. It's like 7:30, 8 o'clock. It's kind of late. We have funky schedules on the human end. So 7:30, 8 o'clock is his witching hour. So we've tried in the morning to play, and he's, again, is like, cool, thanks for the game. I'm still going to be annoying at 7:30 tonight. And as long as it's after 4:30, then that addresses the witching hour. He is not annoying. He's just like his cute little cuddly self. So I give that example to my clients of, if I had tried, you know, tug in the morning for 2 minutes and then said, well, that doesn't work, what do I try next? You know, I would be doing more work for myself. I could say, let's still try tug, but let's try the duration. Let's try the time of the day. You know, let's get really strategic about it. And the nice thing on the client front of that is, you know, in our behavior questionnaire, like history questionnaire, we ask them to tell us what their routine is throughout the day with their pet. And so we can see what they're doing throughout the day. And in talking with them and asking questions of them, you know, we can hear what they're doing. And a lot of times they're doing so much for their animal. And so with that second point of like experimenting with the details and really more to the point, getting strategic about it, is we can tell them, you're already doing a lot and you may not need to do anything more than what you're doing. You may actually be able to take stuff off of your plate at the end of this. But let's just get strategic with how you're doing what you're already doing. And that can help them in not feeling overwhelmed with everything of like, oh, I'm doing so much and you're telling me to do something else. It's like, no, I'm not telling you to do something else. I'm just telling you to get strategic with what you're already doing.
It must be a relief for owners to have a professional come in and say something like that, and even say you might be able to take stuff off your plate.
Yeah, for sure. Like, you know, like I said, our clients are just trying to do the best that they can with the information that they have. And you know, we're fortunate now that a lot of the people who come to us, a lot is a stretch. We have some people who come to us because they've read our book, and those people are doing so much. And it's like, hold on, you're doing a ton of really good work, but you may not have to.
And as part of this, and I'm as you're saying it, I'm reflecting on my own experience running a business and working with Veronica Patelli recently, and her really challenging some of my assumptions that I've made in my life that I carry with me to this day, and being like, hey, no, you don't. You can just change how you think about that. Part of what you're suggesting is shifting mindsets and creating new ways of thinking about. And maybe challenging some limiting beliefs?
I think so. And that's actually kind of a good segue into the third point that I had, which is helping them see if what they're doing is actually working. So I know Emily talked about descriptive versus prescriptive with enrichment, making sure that when you are doing an activity or setting something up for your animal, that you can actually see the effect that activity or whatever it is has on their behavior, to know if it's actually effective. Is it enrichment? You know, taking a descriptive approach. And so going back to changing mindsets for our clients, I think that absolutely fits in. You know, there's not infrequently are people who come to us and say, you know, my dog is bouncing off the walls, and I take them for a 3-mile walk every day. And when I say, well, what happens when you get home? Are they tired? And they're like, no, they're still raring to go. And I'm like, okay, well then that 3-mile walk isn't physical exercise for them. It is for us. Like, I know it's physical exercise for me to go on a 3-mile walk, but for that individual dog, it's not meeting the need. So let's not do it. If it's not working, let's not do it. And I think that's something that I've had to learn time and time again in my life and will continue to have to learn is if something isn't having the effect that it's supposed to have, then don't do it. And to a point, right? Like with behavior, you know, there's tweaks that we can make, we can troubleshoot, we can make something work better. But there also comes a point where we have to just stop trying to force a square peg into a round hole and say, let's see if something like flirt pole is going to have more of an effect on physical exercise than the walk. And usually it does. I have not really met an individual where that hasn't been true, assuming they enjoy playing flirt pole. So I think with that mindset of getting our clients to see, like, the thing that matters is your pet mentally, physically, behaviorally healthy? And that's the biggest thing. It doesn't matter what Joe Schmo on the internet says that you need to do to be a good pet owner. It only matters what your pet says you need to do to be a good pet owner.
So there's potentially a lot of cultural fog about the importance of taking the dog for a walk and how that's going to solve all your problems.
Yeah.
how do you word something like that to a client? Do you guide them to that realization themselves? You're nodding your head as I say.
I am.
That.
Yes. Yeah.
How would you go? Let's say you had a client. They've taken their dog to a 3-mile walk. How long does 3 miles? We do kilometers in New Zealand.
Ooh. Oh gosh. I know the answer to this. It's a little under 5 kilometers.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So a decent walk for a busy person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And they are saying, look, like, he gets enough physical exercise. He's a stubborn dog and he just won't be exercised enough because he wants to annoy me.
Okay. Yes.
And you're there and you can go, okay, cool. That's clearly not working. How might you approach guiding that person softly and tentatively to that conclusion?
So I start with the question, what is the purpose of the walks? And it took me a long time to learn that is a more appropriate first question because I learned over the years that people go on walks for their dogs for a lot of reasons other than exercising their dogs. And if I'm trying to argue the point of, well, this is an exercise and that's not why they're doing it, then I'm just like arguing with myself at that point. So I start with a question of, why do you take your dog on walks? What is the purpose of the walk? And that trips up almost everybody because they haven't thought about why they're doing what they're doing. You know, this is really the first time for a lot of those people that somebody's questioned that. And so if they tell me, I like going on a walk with my dog, then I say, okay, so you can go on a walk with your dog, but let's also add in something that's actually going to be beneficial for your dog. If it's specifically, I'm going on a walk with my dog because I want to exercise them, then usually my next question is, what do they do after the walk? Do you, you know, are they tired, essentially? And if the answer is no, then I'm like, okay, so you're going on a walk with your dog, but it sounded to tire them, but they're not tired. So that doesn't sound like it's very effective. And they're like, yeah, no, it's not. I'm like, all right, cool. We're on the same page. Now let me give you some things that you can do for that. But I think with something like that, because especially something like walks where people are really attached to them for a lot of reasons other than like physical or mental exercise for their pets. And that's valid, right? Like we don't just have pets because we want to care for the pet, or like, you know, we also have them for us. Like we also want to do things with our pets. So I think it either helps them see, going through that questioning, either helps them see, okay, this isn't meeting the goal that I have for this. Let's do plan B. Or it helps them see it's not meeting the goal. And also this is for me as the human. And so I'm going to keep this in my routine and I'm going to find something else specifically for my pet's needs.
I imagine that's quite a... this is reminding me so much of my business mentoring, by the way. Ryan, why are you doing that? So, well, I never really thought about that. It kind of reminds me of standing on a big cliff and there's like this chasm just opened up in front of you and then it's the abyss in there, but Ellie's there, or Victoria, Patelli's there. Veronica Patelli. I was like, Victoria? Where did I get that from? Veronica Patelli's there. They're like, no, give me your hand. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Then that's quite a big motivator, I'm assuming, for, you know, you kind of just shifted their whole paradigm about every time they go for a walk from then on, they're like, why? Why?
Why am I here?
Hey, I have lots of questions, as always I do, but let's push on. Number four.
What did I mean by this? I say identifying their goals is what I wrote down, but I don't know what I meant. No, I do. Okay, I got there. Sorry.
Why are you doing this, Sally?
Why am I doing this?
What's the point?
Identifying their goals. Okay, I knew what I meant. So one of the things that, and again, this is something that I've had to learn a lot as a consultant, is for that intellectual buy-in for people in the long run, they need to know where you're going with things. And so if I have somebody who, not if, when, because it's almost everybody, when I have somebody where I'm like, okay, let's go after some low-hanging fruit here. Let's address some like physical, mental calming exercises, all of that. For me, that is often the low-hanging fruit. And so when I'm talking to people, I'm like, all right, here's what I want you to do. And also, here are the very specific goals that I am after with this experimenting that you are doing. Because what I was finding was I would give people that task and I would say, you know, our goal is, and I would say it in a way that's not, you know, really like behavior consultant speak. I would say like where they're less annoying in the evening, you know, it's something like that, right? Where it's client speak, and they'd come back and they'd be like, yeah, like it's kind of working, or like I kind of did it, or things. And then what I found is when I was really specific about what the intention of those exercises are and what I specifically want them to look for, I found that I got more buy-in with that. And so, for example, I'll say, what I'm looking for is that they rest more in the evening, or they are barking less. And even if it's less intense in the volume, or it's shorter durations, or anything like that, I will take that as barking less. So I'll give them even like a little sub criteria for that. Or we see less reactivity throughout the day, or, you know, giving them actual concrete observations to look for, you know, kind of like you would do as a professional, and just telling them, like, as a professional, this is what I'm looking for, and giving them that criteria, and instead of watering it down for them. I think I assumed that I had to water it down to be at a level that they were comfortable with. And what I'm finding is no. And in that case, the more specific I can get, the better. And I'm getting a lot of better buy-in with that.
I like clearness and specificity. So it resonates with me. Number five.
Number five is tracking that's client friendly. So one of the things that is challenging as a behavior consultant is, you know, taking things from parallel professions that have really intense tracking systems. So like, and especially like the zoological world, like tracking out the wazoo of what behavior looks like and what activities do what, and all of this. And that's just not like, that is a time where, you know, a client would look at that and just be like, I am absolutely not doing this. I did not sign up to have to do that level of tracking in my life. I'm not interested in that. And you kind of lose them that way. But if you have the complete opposite of just like free for all, no tracking, maybe it's happening, maybe it's not, where, you know, they don't always see the progress that they're making. So having something in between the really in-depth stuff that we do as professionals and that we do with other professionals, you know, other people who this is their paid job to observe animals, something in between that and just nothing. So having them, you know, if for us, we either create for them or help them create like an intensity chart of, you know, for this behavior, I just want you to assign it a numerical value depending on the severity of it. And then just like on a calendar, mark down whatever number it is when it happens. Very, very simple, you know, easy to do throughout the day and does not require a lot of extra time, but something where they can see that they are making progress or not making progress, in which case we're like, all right, back to the drawing board. What we are working on isn't working for whatever reason. Let's figure that out, what that reason is. So having tracking, but making sure that it is client friendly for the average super busy pet parent.
I can imagine that there's inbuilt reinforcement in that process. It's an easy approximation. Just pick up a pen and write a number on a piece of paper. And even if there's not a change in numbers over time, which hypothetically there will be frequently, just taking that action. Do you think there's inbuilt reinforcement? Have you seen that? Have you seen that behavior maintained in your clients, even if the non-human learner in the situation's behavior hasn't changed?
I don't know that I've necessarily seen it continue, but I think the only ones that are cropping up are ones where there was progress. And so they're like, it's just like ones and twos now. Like I'm not tracking it that much. I can't necessarily... The other ones that are fresh on my mind for this are people who are doing a little bit more in-depth tracking because they're trying to figure out what their pet's triggers are, where they're having like a lot of trigger stacking, or they can't figure out exactly what's going on or why it's going on. And so those people are doing more in-depth. And for those people that like doing that, I should say, I a lot of times find those people continue with it far after the point that we really need to. So yes and no is my answer to your question.
It's a satisfactory answer, Ellie.
We'll okay.
I'm joking.
I'm glad.
Great. Hey, number one was identifying our clients' pain points, all of their pain points.
Yes.
So that's quite early on in your process, isn't it? You've been caught up because they've got separation anxiety, but part of your initial questioning is, tell me a little bit more about your the average day for your animal and your routine. And what do you also ask what they like about their animals? That do you kind of how do you maintain their focus on?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question because I don't normally ask that because people usually offer that information, and I mean I don't know nearly enough about the way that humans work and operate to have an idea of what this covert behavior is. But it kind of seems like if I was just like postulating, it kind of seems like they feel guilty about like telling somebody all the things they don't like about this individual who they really love most of the time. Sometimes, you know, people are there and you're like, you should just not have that. Like, this relationship is not here. Like, you should just not have this animal. But most times people just offer that freely. And I think it's kind of cute. I think humans are just adorable to me. Like, I just love watching humans interact with the world. In that a lot of times when we get a questionnaire, even they'll be like, here's all this terrible stuff. Like, here's my dog's entire bite history. And then at the end where it says, you know, is there anything else you want to tell us? They're like, they're really sweet, I promise. I'm like, I trust you. I believe you. just don't be a stranger coming into the house and then you're fine. So I think people, at least for me, I don't know if you have this experience too, but people a lot of times just like offer that freely of the things that they really like as kind of like a, but don't think that they're all bad, you know?
Yeah. I guess I'm training myself to always look for those and look for reinforceable behaviors and celebrate those as well. Yeah. So I enjoy helping keep those at the front of conversations at the same time as obviously diving into everything else. Number two that you offered us was having your client experiment with the details. And I really liked that. I was thinking about as summer has entered our world, our daughter, and the amount of allocated attention adult humans can give has to be divvied up even more among the many inhabitants of Cartilage State. We've seen changes in behavior. Our cat Tilo decided that Phoebe was a good thing to jump on unexpectedly from around barriers.
Oh, no.
So we've managed to create an environment outside where we can take Tilo. She's a house cat and play with a flirt pole and pretty much get the behavior of jumping on Phoebe down to zero, close to zero. But it's so interesting to hear you talk today and realize I haven't played with the details. I'm not sure, you know, what happens if we do that in the morning versus the afternoon and when is the optimal time. I notice sometimes we take her outside, she's like, nah, I'm going to go back inside now. Okay. You know, so that was really helpful for me. Thank you for sharing that. I'll be playing around with that moving forward with Tilo. Number three, helping them see what they're doing is actually working. How does that tie into number five as well, tracking things? So helping them see what they're doing is actually working in a way that works for them, which is number five.
Yeah, so absolutely, like those two things go into it and play into each other really well, where first we just need to get them on the page of, is what you're currently doing actually working for you? Yes, no, right. Maybe. And then number five, getting really strategic about being able to figure that out for themselves moving forward with the tracking that actually works for them, you know, at the level that they're at, where at whichever level that they're at. Every now and then I get somebody who's like, I do research analysis on the collegiate level. And I'm like, cool. So like they like make just like charts and like graphs for me. I'm like, this is amazing. But I think in my head, that third one is helping them see where they're currently at. And
right. I understand.
And that number five is being able to figure that out for themselves moving forward.
Right. So number three is kind of like baseline right now based on what you've anecdotally been observing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Number five is a little bit more analytical. Mm-hmm. Number four is what are their goals? So number one, identifying our clients' pain points, all of the pain points. Number two, have your clients experiment with the details. Number three, helping them find baseline, helping them see what they're doing might not actually be working. Number four, identifying their goals. And number five, tracking things from a client's perspective.
Yes.
Awesome. Hey, thanks so much for sharing all of that, Ellie. That was a great list, and I really enjoyed learning all of those points that you bring to your work as a behavior consultant. And I think that's really going to benefit a large majority, if not all of our audience of this podcast show. Sadly, though, we are now at the final question for this episode. Ellie, we started off with 13-year-old dreamer you. Now yes. I'm curious about what your dreams are for the future. Can you take us into the next 5 to 10 years? What do you really want to see happen in our community?
I knew that was going to be a question, and I still was not fully prepared to have a succinct answer for you. I think, because like there's so much that I want to see happen in our community. I think one of the things that is fresh on my mind is having it truly be a community, and it's fresh on my mind because we have our Pro Campus membership group, and we were just talking about that in that group a couple of days ago of how nice it is to actually have a community where people are supportive and understanding of your learning journey. And I think that's something that in the just like the animal training space in general, we're kind of hard on each other, and we have a long way to go to have a true community of people helping one another and instead of criticizing one another. So I think that's one of the things fresh on my mind of where I'd like to see us go 5-10 years from now. Another one is something I very briefly mentioned earlier today, in that having more continuing education opportunities on the human side of things, you know, and of course, like we are not human therapists. We will never be human therapists. Like we're not talking about that level of things, but I've really seen just in my own, in my own career, how vital it is to be an empathetic consultant for our human learners, and how much I still have to go in building those skills. You know, we have somebody on our team, Mary Kay, who has a background in social work. She I don't remember how long she was a social worker for, but has a background in social work, and I watch her work with people, and I'm like, oh my gosh, like the skills that you have are amazing. And I recognize it's because she has a background in working with humans in that capacity. And so I'd love to see those skills be more at the forefront in our profession, that it's not just about the skills that you have with an animal. It's also a non-human animal. It's also about the skills that you have with a human. And that's not like something to just, you know, be swept away and all of that. So I think that's another place I'd really like to see us go And I'm going to say those are the two things on my mind right now for that.
It sounds like you're saying that Ryan likes to twist your words into his own frame of reference and worldview.
Go for it.
It sounds like you're saying treat human learners as we treat our canine learners.
Absolutely.
Focus Lima on reinforceable behaviors. Lima Beings is the new project that's been started by some of our colleagues. So go check that out. Kevin Stay, Chris Bockel.
It's awesome.
Marissa Martino, Lynn, I can't remember Lynn's last name. I'm forgetting people now. I'm feeling really bad. But you can Google that. But I love that these approximations are taken by people in our industry. And I'm curious, fostering a community, as you mentioned earlier, in your community, people were talking about being supportive and feeling understood in their own learning journey. How do you and your team foster that in your online community? What antecedents and consequences have you put in place to create that environment?
For us, I think a thing that's helped us a lot is being really vulnerable about our own journeys. And so, you know, within our group, you know, we celebrate successes, you know, we have Success Sunday of just like, tell us about what's good in your life right now. And Struggle Bus Saturday, where it's like, tell us about what's not great in your life right now and how can we help? And one of the things that I try to do is share the things I'm struggling with as much as the things that I'm succeeding with. And I think having kind of stepping up to the plate first of saying like, here are the things that I'm struggling with. You know, I'm really struggling with motivation this week and not being angry at everybody who contacts me. And, you know, the things that we all deal with or like, I'm just going to say all so I feel better about myself. The things we all deal with at some point in time so that other people can identify with that and say like, okay, I'm also struggling with that this week. You know, it's sometimes easier to say, like, oh, that's a thing that I'm going through too, as opposed to being the first person to talking about that. So having that vulnerability ourselves has been really helpful for us with fostering that. And I think too, meeting our learners where they are and helping to shape them. So, you know, if we have someone who says something where we're like, okay, that's not necessarily what I would have chosen to do this, but tell me more about that. You know, tell me why you did it that way. Have you thought about this? You know, all of that and helping to shape them over time instead of just saying like, well, I wouldn't have done it that way. You know, how social media tends to tends to go about those arguments, or not even arguments. You know, for us, it's just like a point of discussion, and making sure that we're giving them the benefit of the doubt first. Of you're doing the best you can with the knowledge and skill set you have, and it's our job to help you get to the next level through approximations and not force.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for sharing that and living up to what you said, walking the walk and talking the talk. Both you and Emily have been vulnerable in these episodes, so we're grateful for that. And hopefully as someone listening to these episodes, that's been helpful for you, that maybe if you're going through something similar, you feel you're not alone. Just before we do officially wrap up today, though, Ellie, I know we mentioned this towards the start of the episode, but could you please just remind everyone listening where they can go to find out more about you, what you do, and get in touch?
Absolutely. We are Pet Harmony Training pretty much everywhere. So petharmonytraining.com is our website where you can see all of our services and things that we offer, and, you know, bios and things if you want to learn more about us. We are at Pet Harmony Training on Facebook, Instagram, and kind of Pinterest. But right now, mostly Facebook and Instagram. We also have Facebook groups specifically for enrichment for pet behavior issues is one, more for the pet parent side of things. So we have a lot of professionals in that group as well. And we have a group specifically for professionals so that we can help continue fostering more of a community in that space too. So that is where to find us. We do also have a free enrichment chart download at petharmonytraining.com/enrichment chart.
Wonderful. And as mentioned, we will, of course, link to all of this in the show notes for this episode. Ellie, this has been a ton of fun. So from myself and on behalf of everyone listening to this episode, we really appreciate everything that you do and for taking the time to come on the show today. It's very appreciated. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Ryan. It was fun.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much, everyone, for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.